About how it must have been living out there in this house probably 100 years ago. We went around and back, and there was an overgrown garden, and it had barbed wire around it. And I said, this has got to be old. I've never seen barbed wire like this. I looked it up, and it was patented later. I looked it up in like 1862. But it's a flat piece of wire about the size of your finger, and one edge is like pinking shears. You know, like you cut cloth, and it makes little jagged edges, and then it was twisted. I said, I have never seen barbed wire like that. As I said, I found it was patented back in the mid-1800s. So we're looking around, talking about this abandoned house, when all of a sudden we hear muffled footsteps inside the house. My friend and I look at each other, and we realize someone is living in this house. So we turn slowly and start walking back across the field. I've finished my sandwich, so I have potato chips I'm eating. He's in front of me, and about that time I hear a screen door slam. Now, I know what a screen door sounds like because my mom used to say, David, don't slam the, bam, screen door. And then I'd have to go in and out five times, right, without shutting the door. Do you ever do that? Your mom makes you go back in and don't slam the door. I know what a screen door sounds like, and I heard a screen door slam. And we're about halfway back. My friend's in front of me. I turn around, I look, and down the back steps underneath that house comes the biggest, baddest, meanest-looking dog I have ever seen in my life. Running full speed, its mouth wide open, growling like a bear. Now I turn around, and I know I'm in the middle of this field, nowhere to run. And my friend, what do you think I found out later he was doing? He's making it back to the boat. But I'm standing there with a potato chip in this hand. I turn around. I know I can't outrun this dog. So I remember a game I used to play, and you probably did too, called Freeze or Statue. You know, where you throw it and you can't move, right? So I figured my plan is to not move. So I'm standing with a potato chip in this hand, a bag in this hand, and I just freeze. And this dog stops about 10 feet from me, and he starts real stiff-legged, and his mouth is wide open. The hair on the back of his neck is up. I'm looking right down his throat. And you know those four big long teeth? Do you know what they're called? Canine, or some people, kids call them fangs, you know, but canine. What do you think they're made for? To tear and rip, you know, and I'm thinking about my leg, and I'm playing statue. About that time, out on the front porch comes what I call Mr. Clean, if you remember the Mr. Clean commercials. This great big guy, he has no hair, no shirt, no shoes, and I'm about to find out he has no heart. And this dog is just slowly growling constantly in this real stiff-legged walking up towards me, and I'm doing the statue bit, but my lips start to move as I look at that man, and I cannot create, I'm sure, the sound of my voice or the fear that I was feeling. Said, can you call that dog off? And Mr. Clean, as I call him, this is what he did. He was standing there like this. Now that's a universal sign for no, right? And I knew at that time this guy not only had no hair, no shirt, no shoes, but he had no heart because I knew he could call that dog off. So it's back to me and the dog. So I stand there playing statue, and the dog is getting closer and closer. And I'm thinking, well, maybe if I offered a potato chip. So I kind of put this potato chip out, and the dog goes, and he jumped back, and I'm telling you, I just about, back to statue bit, right? So this dog circles around, and it circles around to my left. And I'm thinking, what's it going to be like when those real sharp canine teeth tear into my leg? About that time, all of a sudden, on my right leg, I feel this warm, wet liquid. And I look down, and it's a male dog's guy's leg up, and he's decided my leg is a fire hydrant. Now, this is the dog that growls like a bear and has big canine teeth. You think I'm going to tell him, stop doing that? Uh-uh. That's what he wants to do, and not bite me. That's fine with me. He drops his leg and goes trotting back to the house like he's not a care in the world. He is so happy. And my friends who know animals tell me later he was marking his territory saying, hey, this is my territory. Mr. Clean opens the door. The dog goes into the house. Mr. Clean goes into the house. Now, what do you think I did? Well, very slowly. People say, oh, you ran back. That dog might come back out. I turn very slowly, and I slowly walk back to the boat with my wet pant leg flapping in the breeze. There's my friend in the boat. He's got this big grin on his face. He thinks it's so funny, and I'm telling you, I still don't think it's funny. My heart's going pitter-patter, pitter-patter. So we get in the boat and get out of there, and at the time I was working at First National Bank in Fort Myers, and I didn't go in until 10 because I worked on the computers, and my friend worked there, and he went in bright and early. Now, when I went in Monday morning, do you think he kept that story a secret? No, he's told everybody. He's told the tellers. He's told the ladies in bookkeeping. He's told the vice president. He's told the janitors. He's starting to tell the people that are coming in to make their deposits and stuff. So I figure today there are at least three people telling this story. Now, what three do you think we know are probably telling that story? Me, right? My friend. It has to be the funniest thing to be sitting in that boat and see this unfold. And Mr. Clean obviously had to be telling that story. So what I encourage you, you're welcome to tell that story. If you'll just say where you got it from me here at the Florida Folk Festival, please go ahead and tell that story. And I want to end this story by saying I had some real insight, because good stories are to give you insight. And one of the insights I had, I remember back, as that dog was trotting off, I realized that dog and I really have something in common. And at that time, what it was is we were both relieved. I stood there and I looked down, the dog kind of, but I went back to my statue bit and I said, no way. And that is exactly how that occurred with me down in Fort Myers, Florida. But then moving on up to, we'll move on up. I was going to say Orlando, but we'll skip Orlando right now and move up to Jacksonville, because I'm a visual person. And let me tell you about last Halloween, October the 31st, 1997. I don't know where you were, but I was driving out of Jacksonville to St. Augustine in a monsoon. It was pouring down rain. And I was on my way to St. Augustine because our storytelling group has what's called Ghost Walk. And at the Spanish Quarter Museum in St. Augustine, there's a series of buildings there that's a museum. And on Halloween, to raise money for a local charity, they have storytellers. There's about seven, and we are to come tell a ghost story, whatever we want to be, and we dress in costume, and the sun starts to go down, and it gets kind of eerie, and we're on different porches and around the property, and groups go around, and they go to a storyteller, and they hear seven different stories. And so I'm on my way down there about 5 o'clock in the rain, steering the car with my knees, which is not really a good deal. The reason is I've got this blue stuff that I'm putting on my hand, because you, obviously if you're going to tell Halloween stories, you need to look different. And then I have the cotton white slacks on and a raincoat and my Panama Jack hat, a bottle of ketchup in my pocket, and a pair of scissors up here, because I'm going to tell the story I just told you. I'm going to tell that story, only I'm going to make it on Halloween at night and make it a scary story. And then it's going to have the ending that I told you. And I'm going to use the ketchup to cut my pants and make it look like I was bitten, and people will think that it was a real scary story, and they'll have this funny ending. That's my plan. So I'm putting this blue on, and I'm thinking, you know, how do you wash this off, right? Water. It's raining. I don't think this is going to work. I roll the window down, kind of put my hand out, and sure enough, it's water soluble. So I said, I'm not putting more of this blue stuff. So I drive into St. Augustine with my one blue hand and my ketchup and my scissors, and I get out, and it stopped raining, and I walk down St. George Street. St. George Street is one of the oldest streets in the oldest city, and it's made curving. And the reason it's made curving is so they could defend it. The soldiers from Indians or the enemy, as they walk by, they could fall back and defend it. And I'm walking down St. George Street. The shops, some of them are open, but there's hardly anyone on the street. And here's a sign that says the Ghost Walk has been canceled because of inclement weather. Now, my friends had left me a note on my answering machine at 2 o'clock, but did I check it? No. I decided, okay, I'm going to have a great evening. I'm down here in St. Augustine. I don't come that often. So I walk back to the public bathhouse that's there, and I wash the blue off my hand because it seems kind of odd to be walking around in public with a blue hand. And I go back to my car and put my scissors and my ketchup in the car. And I walk back up to the Milltop. It's a tavern there, and I go up, and the guy that's been there for like 20 years plays, and he's a storyteller. He tells about growing up in New England. He plays his great songs. So I had a cold beer and some Cajun French fries, and I'm sitting there really enjoying myself, and it's getting to be nighttime. The sun's gone down. It's time for me to go home. So I go back down and walk back down St. George Street. St. George Street's curving. There is absolutely nobody on the street except this couple walking in front of me with their arms around each other, and the shops, a few of them are open, and the light's coming out, and you can see the wetness of the street, and it's drizzling a little bit. I'm thinking, I wonder how many hundreds of people have walked down this street over the years that this street has been here. The couple turns around, and they ask me some directions, and I don't really know my way around there, and I say, the Milltop can probably help you out. And they walk on, and I look over, and in the corner there, there's a young man sitting on a bench, and he has a baseball cap and a shirt on, and he's hands on his knees. And as I walk down the street by myself, he stands up, and I think, I'm about to hear a story. And he says, on my way to Miami, my car broke down. And that, and I give money out to people on occasion, but that night I really didn't feel up to that. And I said, not tonight. And I walked on past him, and I took 7 or 8 steps, and then I heard this voice say, you know, this isn't easy. And it went right to my heart, you know, and I turned and looked, and this young man is just standing there, his baseball cap and his shirt on, and he's just standing there. There's no one else on the street. I walked back to him, and I said, well, you know, we all have our stories. He said, oh, that's true. My car really did break down. Now, I'm not sure. I find this hard to believe, but I walk up to him, and I said, my name's David, and your name? And his name, said his name is Jeff. I said, well, Jeff, I came down here. I don't mean that what you told me wasn't true, but I came down to be Ghost Walk. He said, oh, Ghost Walk, I know all about that. He said, I do artwork, and I do pencil drawings, and I'm down here a lot, and I've attended that before, and it's great. Were you going to be one of the storytellers? I said, yes, I was. He said, well, he said, the police ran me off the other night, and I was robbed by some people. I said, and we're standing there in the street just, you know, by ourselves. And I said, Jeff, that must have really feel very scary to have that happen. And he said, yeah, he said, I was really scared. And I said, well, I've been told feelings are neither right nor wrong, that they just are. He said, are you a psychic? I said, Jeff, no, I'm just quite a bit older than you, and I've probably experienced a lot of those feelings, so I can empathize with that. And then he said, you know what I'm really, really upset about is my brother killed himself. Now, you understand I've only talked to this young man for like a minute here. And we're standing there, and I said, well, tell me about that, Jeff. He said, well, he got drunk on his motorcycle 2 years ago and hit a tree, and he said, I'm really mad at him. And I said, well, Jeff, that reminds me of a story, Jeff. And I said, here's the story I told Jeff. I said, when I was in Jacksonville for a number of years, friends and I had a computer company, and Bill Pope fixed our computers, Jeff. And I came in one morning, and he was back there having a cup of coffee telling 3 or 4 of the employees what a miserable thing had happened to him over the weekend. Somebody broke into his garage and stole his tools. His tools belonged to his dad. They had a lot of sentimental value. And everybody's talking about, you know, this world is not a safe place that we live in. People are stealing things, drugs, and they on and on and on. And I'm listening to this. And so I said to Bill, I said, Bill, do you know who stole your tools? He said, no. I said, did you make a police report? He said, yes. I said, well, how about this? I think it was a man that has 6 kids and an invalid wife, and he needed the tools to go to work. Of course, everybody said, oh, yeah, sure. I said, well, do you know who stole your tools? No. Did you make a police report? Yes. I said, well, my story is as good as these other people's story then. And Bill had a sense of humor, and we got to talking about the man with 6 kids and an invalid wife that took his tools. And I said, your kids, because he has teenagers, I said, they're probably upset about this. I said, oh, yeah, we're all upset. Somebody broke into our place and took our tools and my dad's. I said, well, you might tell them this story. Came in the next day, and he said he went home and told the kids, and they started joking about it, and they made this whole scene up. A couple weeks later, Jeff, Bill came in, and both of his kids' bicycles were stolen. They made a police report. The police said, hey, we're never going to find those bicycles. But Bill said to me, you know what my kid said? He said, these kids have 2 invalid parents, and they really need a job delivering newspaper. So I looked at Jeff, and I said, Jeff, you know what? You might tell yourself a different story about why your brother was killed. And I reached in, and I gave him a couple dollars, and I said, Jeff, I bet you don't give very many hugs out here on the street, do you? He said, no, I don't. So we gave each other a hug, and I turned around and walked back to my car down St. George Street, and I thought, wow, I'm really glad it rained tonight. So, yeah, I'm feeling it's up to whatever you... Okay. And you're welcome. I realize you have other places to go, and I'm fine with that. So I'll tell you then about what happened with me in Orlando. Sure. Matt Ricozzi grew up in Florida. And the thing about telling stories, and you're all storytellers, just ask people to tell you something about when they grew up, their first kiss, the first time they got out of high school, the first time their pet died. Ask your mom, your dad, your grandmother, and people will just start telling these stories. And the thing about that is, you start hearing other stories. So I was telling one of my stories, and I worked with Matt down in Orlando, and I had just met him, and he said, well, let me tell you this story. And this is a story Matt told me. Matt said, when I was 12 years old, there were 6 of us, all boys in the family. And he said, one day I got up to go to school, and I... 5 minutes. All right, I can do that. He said, I got up to go to school, and he said, I told... my brother, John, I said, hey, John, he's only in the first grade. You want to play hooky? Have any of you guys ever had an older brother or sister get you in trouble? Or have you ever got one of your younger brothers and sisters in trouble? Okay, you can remember that. This is what's going on. Now, John, all he knew is his big brother whispered. And when your big brother whispers, that means there's something going on that you're not supposed to let anybody know. He didn't even know what playing hooky was. Well, they got time to go to school, so Matt and John hopped on their bicycles. They rode off, but instead of going to school, they went down the alley behind Schaefer's Pharmacy and hid. Now, why are they hiding? Not supposed to be doing that, right? Well, they waited till the four brothers go off to school, Mom and Dad goes off to work, and then Matt said, okay, John, let's go back. So they ride their bikes back, hide the bikes in the garage, right? Because you're doing something you're not supposed to be doing, and your neighbors can't see the bikes. Go around, pick up the rock, find the little plastic bag with the key in it, right? Open the door, go inside. Now, this is the first time these two boys have been in their home by themselves. No one else is there. What do you think two boys, 12 and 6 years old, what's the first thing they do inside the house? What do you guys think? Jump on the bed, go for the icebox. Exactly, they raid the refrigerator. That's exactly what they went in there. They opened up, and when you got six kids, they have great big multi-gallon, like 3 or 4 gallons of ice cream. But Mom says, no, you're not supposed to eat that, right? You let Mom dish that out. But they, Matt gets a spoon, he reaches down there and gets a little bit of ice cream, and they have a little bit more, and 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 oh, we better not get any more because Mom's going to find out about that. And then they go, and they go checking out the place. And Matt said they went in their mom and dad's bedroom and looked through the drawers to see if there was anything in there they're not supposed to know about. You don't know why you would do that. I can't imagine. But they wandered around. They couldn't go outside. They watched television, but somebody would see them because they're doing something they're not supposed to be doing. So I call this story the couch because there was this beautiful couch in there, and John got the idea. There's a small coffee table. He goes down the hallway past the brother's bedroom, Mom and Dad, and he runs down the hallway over the coffee table into the couch with his shoes on. Now, are you supposed to jump on the furniture? No, no way, right? And with your shoes on? No way, but Mom and Dad aren't there. But that was pretty easy. John did it. Well, they go get a couple pillows off the bed, and they stack those up. Matt jumps over that. John jumps over that, slam into the couch with her shoes on. Finally, they get two more pillows, so they got four. They do it again. It's getting close to 3 o'clock. Mom comes home. Oh, we got time for one more. So they go to their mom and dad's bedroom. Two more pillows stick up there. Now John's got a hole in them. They're kind of rocking back and forth. Matt goes running down the hallway over the pillow, splat into the couch. Wham! All four legs break off the couch. Oh, my gosh. Mom's going to be home in a little bit. Are they going to be in big trouble? Of course. They throw the couch up. They put the legs back on as best they can. They get the vacuum cleaner out. There's little pieces of wood in the shag carpet. They put the couch back. They put all the pillows back. They go to their mom's bedroom. Now they're in big trouble. You know why they're in big trouble? Because they can't make the bed as well as her mom can. They realize that. They put the pillows back. It doesn't. They pull it as tight. It's almost 3 o'clock. They go back out. They look at the couch. Matt said he can swear that couch was sitting there going, he just knew it. They got to go. They run out. They lock the house, put the key in the plastic bag under the rock, ride their bikes behind the alley in Schaefer's Pharmacy. Hearts going pitter-patter. Finally, they got to go home. You know, they got to go home. School's out. They ride back. You know, they act like nothing happened. They go in. Matt says, I know that couch. I could just hear it going, "Rrr." But they go in. They have dinner. Dad comes out with his cup of coffee. You know where he sits? No, he doesn't sit on the couch. He sits in his favorite chair. Now, Matt and John are watching television. Do you think they're sitting on the couch? They're on the floor, right? Mom comes out, magazine. Where does she sit? On her favorite chair, not on the couch. Couple brothers come out, and they jump where? Right on the couch, right? You know what happens? Nothing. It's Thursday night. Matt and John are sitting there. They just know that couch is going to fall any minute. They get through Thursday night. They go to bed. Matt says he pulls the covers up, and he says his eyes are wide open. He can't go to sleep because he can hear that couch out there. Finally, he gets out. He goes to school the next day. He gets this notice. You ever hear that speaker where they say, would you please come to the principal's office? Oh, and he goes to the principal's office, and there's John sitting there. And they get called in, and there's his mom and dad. And he's thinking, what turned him in? You know what turned him in? Well, his message to have his friend call and say they were sick wasn't very good, but it was the ice cream and the pillows. His mom figured out there's some ice cream missing, and she could tell her bed wasn't the way it was supposed to be. So they thought they had it made, okay, until that time came up. And so Matt said, you know, from then on, he went to school every day. And every time he saw that couch, he could just hear that couch going. Rrr.
That was David Tolbert. In lieu of Vassar Clements, I'd like to thank David for performing admirably in The Gap. And David, stick around for 1 minute.
Drum that is used in Trinidad, that has and comes from the East Indian heritage of Trinidad. There is a gentleman who does Russian icons. There is a woman who does Rangoli, which is an East Indian tradition of decorating, putting elaborate decorations on the floor, and a few other things. So that's definitely a place worth visiting. You have a chance to meet the artists directly and talk with them and find out a little bit more about their traditions, which is also the nice thing about this stage, because we have a chance to actually sit down with the artists and get more insight than you would normally be able to obtain just watching a performance on a stage. Anyways, up next, we are really pleased that the Indac Filipino Dance Group is here and is going to talk to us a little bit about some of the dances of the Philippines, and hopefully give us a few demonstrations and maybe try to get one or two of you involved as well. And we have their director, Aurora Hansen, who I think is trying to get the technical situation straightened out, and then she's going to come up here. And we're also really pleased that an old friend from Miami, which is where I'm from, Mrs. Lucille Fuller, is with us. And she's one of our great storytellers of the Miami area. And we saw her walking across the field and quickly grabbed her and asked her if she could come over and do a substitution for us as well. So she's going to come up and tell a story in a little bit as well. So, Aurora, if you all are ready, we can probably... Okay, well, maybe you and me can talk for a minute or two. Okay.
I'll just do the demonstration. That's fine.
Again, this is Mrs. Aurora Hansen from the Indac Filipino Dance Group. Maybe I'll just ask you a few questions so people have a little bit of background information before they see the dancers. And I should warn you all in advance, they have beautiful costumes, but since we kind of grabbed them away from another stage, they probably aren't going to have a chance to put on those costumes for this performance, but you will be able to see their full performance at another stage a little later. Anyways, Aurora, maybe you all are based in what part of Florida?
We live in Tallahassee. And the students that perform with me are students at FSU and TCC. And most of them were either born in the Philippines, raised in the United States, or born in the United States with Filipino-American parents or Filipino parents who have lived here for years and years and years. And the reason why we started this company is to give them a little bit more of a feeling of the culture and just to touch base with their roots. And dance in the Philippines is the best way for you can touch base with your culture. And most of these kids have always wanted me to start something and so that they can dance and learn.
And how about you yourself? How did you learn these dances?
Dances in Filipinos learn how to dance by the time they're born. As soon as you're born, they're getting you ready. There's little games that we play as children. One of them is I'll play with you right now. If you make a fist with your hands. And yeah, I tease people. This is your carpal tunnel syndrome exercise, okay? So you do this all the time, too, when you're stretching. And the little kids do this, and we say this little rhyme. Arimunding, munding, munding, munding. Arimunding, munding, munding, munding. Arimunding, munding. And you do this, rotating it to the outside and to the inside. And what the little kids do is they start learning this kind of movement. And you'll see little children, you'll go, arimunding, munding, and they'll go. It's like, oh, okay, this is what we're doing. And that's probably where you see all these hands too, all the little softness. The hands play a very big part in dance in the Philippines, the face and the hands. Pretty much like the Hawaiian culture, too. A lot of our dances, too, I started dancing formally with the dance company, with the National Dance Company of the Philippines at age 6.
Wow.
And have been started touring with them at age 15. It's the Bayanihan Philippine Dance Company, And I was part of the first children's company that started with the original people that started that company.
And did you originally learn from your mother or your family, or how did
my father danced in a national dance company also, okay. And it's part of our Filipino families, rich or poor, you learn how to dance, and there's always a musical instrument in the house. You learn the bandurria, you learn the ukulele, you learn the guitar, you learn the piano, you learn how to sing. So they want us to be all triple threats, I guess.
And one of the things about the Philippines is it's such a complex country. It's so many peoples have settled there, or different cultures have had an influence on the country. Maybe if you could give us a little bit of background, because it seems that you have to know a little bit about that to understand all the different types of dance that you have.
The Philippines, the influence in the Philippines is Indo-Malaysian, Chinese, a very broad number of cultures. The Philippines has 7,100 islands. We were under Spain for over 500 years. We were under the United States for over 40 years. And there were a lot. We were under the Japanese. We had a lot of influences. A long, long time ago, the lands were connected by land, not by sea. We were separated by all this, the sea. Indonesia, Malaysia, Borneo, Brunei, we were all connected somehow. And the people from the northern part of the Philippines have the Negroid blood in for their ancestry. And so the people up in the northern part of the Philippines are a lot darker. The lower you go, all the way to the south, the skin tone changes. Because the people down in the south were influenced by Indonesia, Malaysia, and those are all where you find the kings and the queens and the royalty. The Philippines has three big major islands. Real, real easy. You need a partner.
Okay, let's...